So today I'm going to tell you about some of the work I've been doing with regards to looking at the nonlinear dynamics of binary black holes in Einstein's yellow Gaussian gravity. But before diving into this topic, I thought I'll give you a bit of context here. So the goal of my research is really to make detailed predictions of new physics in the strong gravity regime, and in particular within the context of cosmology and high energy physics, but also space-time surrounding compact objects. And so in particular, during my PhD, I spent a lot of time thinking about the problem of initial conditions in cosmology and how we can adapt the tools of normal relativity to study nonlinearities in cosmological spacetimes. So for instance, one of the questions I looked at was what happens to black holes in non-singular bouncing models? And then more recently, I also looked at this question of how generic initial conditions can be for inflation to start. Now, this is not what I'm going to talk about today, but I thought it was still worth mentioning. What I'm going to talk about instead is how we can use gravitational waves to find modifications of general relativity, and in particular, how we can use binary black hole mergers in specific modified frees of gravity, so by doing numerical simulations to constrain our field of gravity. Okay, and so maybe before moving on, one theme for this talk that I want to point out is that we are already starting to probe these extreme regimes using gravitational wave, but also cosmological observations. But the theory is really lagging behind in the sense that if we had a better understanding of this nonlinear regime, we could be doing better and place stronger constraints on our theory of gravity. So this is really the goal here. Okay. So I hope I don't have to convince you that gravitational waves emitted during the merger of compact objects is a very promising target if what you are after is finding modifications of general relativity. Now, the caveat is that there's very few modified theories of gravity out there that are in the same theoretical footing as GR, in the sense that you can give a complete answer to what happens when black holes merge in this theory. And so what people have done instead is they've been testing our theory using those so-called either model-independent tests or either just like, you know, focusing on the weak field regime. So here, for instance, you can see some of those tests which I took from the testing GR paper of LIGO's third observing run. Now, even though I'm not saying that all those tests are not exciting, they're all very exciting, but the problem is that if you actually want to take their constraints, so for instance, here you have the results of this so-called parameterized PN tests. If you want to take the constraints and map them to specific theories of modified gravity, you will find it to be either quite hard or ambiguous. And so this really motivates the need for theory-specific waveforms that cover the in-spiral merger and ring down. So now the question is, well, I don't know if you guys are all aware of, but there's many theories of modified gravity out there. So which one do we actually pick? The one we will be looking at is shift symmetric Einstein scalar Gaussian gravity, which is given by the following action here. So as a reminder, you have this scalar field here, which is non-millimic coupled to the space-time metric through the Gaussian invariant, which I defined here. And then you have this coupling function beta, which basically tells you about the flavor of your theory. And so here we will restrict ourselves to the shift symmetric, which I will explain what that would be later on. And then you have this like coupling function constant here, lambda, which is dimensions of length squared. So at this point, you might be thinking, why are we considering this particular theory over another? Well, the reason is that if you kind of follow this EFT approach, then you'll find that this theory is basically the leading order correction to gravity coupled to a scalar field in four dimensions and assuming parity symmetry. So in that sense, what I'm saying is that this theory can be really seen as the low energy limit of many UV complete theories out there you might be thinking of. More importantly for us, turns out that this theory has second order equations of motion, by which I mean it's a Hondensky theory. And for us, it's very important because it means it's potentially well posed. Then as a bonus, turns out that this theory is actually quite interesting from a phenomenological point of view, because for this shift symmetric form I picked earlier, you can show that black holes will have scalar charge, which for a fixed coupling is going to be inversely proportional to the smallest mass in your system squared. And so this means that black holes in this theory will emit scalar dipole radiation and so will spiral faster than in GR, which also means that potentially you could have some observable effects that allow us to distinguish this theory from GR. And this is really what we are after here. And then I thought before moving on, I'll just mention one more thing is that this theory has been tested quite extensively recently. So first of all, whilst using low mass X-ray binaries, but then also more recently using gravitational wave detections, with the most stringent bounds coming from using PN predictions of this theory during the spiral on black hole neutron star events of LIGO's third observing bound. And so maybe I'll just make one thing clear first, is that I'm certainly not claiming that this is the true theory of gravity out there, and certainly not with, a coupling which is at the kilometer scale. But I still think it's very important to, at least we can try and give an answer of what the gravitational wave signal looks like in a modified theory of gravity. And I think it's very important to have a few example theories we can do this so that we can then come up with more meaningful theory agnostic tests and make sure we are testing things from first principles. So that's what we were after here. Okay, so now that we have a theory, well, how do we go from here to an accurate numerical waveform? It turns out there's actually three approaches in the literature to do this. The first one is the so-called order reduction approach, where what you do is you assume you're in the weak coupling regime, you perturb your space-time metric and scalar field about a GR background, and then you evolve the corrections to the space-time metric on this background. Now, this is nice because it means that your equations of motion will be well-posed at each order, but the problem is that this perturbative scheme will lead to secular growth during the spiral, which means that you can really only focus on the merger, and even then it's a bit hard to quantify whether what you're getting is actually physical or not. So this brings me to the second approach, where what you do instead is you follow this EFT approach and you change the behavior of your theory at short wavelengths so that you now have a well-posed system with ideally the same low-energy behavior. Now, again, here the problem is that you need to add a short length scale, which can be quite ad hoc, and it can be quite hard, again, to quantify the errors introduced by this method. And so this brings me to the final approach, which is the one we will be considering, and that's you just solve the full equations. So no approximations here. So of course, this is the ideal scenario. So now you might be thinking, well, why does not everyone do that? Well, it's not that simple. To solve the full equations, you need a well-posed initial value formulation, which until recently we didn't have for modified theories of gravity. Now, we were very lucky that for the theory we want to look at, so the Hondensky theories, well, Kovacs and Rial showed very recently that if you use a modified generalized harmonic formulation, then those theories should be well posed in a weak coupled regime, which means that we can actually solve them on a computer. And so that's what I'm going to do now. Before I show you some results, I just wanted to mention that very recently, Gilbert Salo and collaborators showed that if you modify the CCZ4 formulation, those Hondensky theories are also well posed in the weakly coupled regime. So this is a very active field of research. Okay, so we have a well posed initial value formulation. So the one thing left to do is really just pick a system we want to study. So the one we decided to look at is quasi-circular binary black hole mergers. And the reason is simple. This is what LIGO has been seeing the most. So we might as well start there. So in this movie, I'm going to show you the scalar field surrounding an equal mass black hole binary in the very last few stages of the spiral.
Sorry, so all the colors at the amplitude?
Yeah. So as you can see, the curvature length scale of the final remnant is larger, and so the scalar charge is reduced. So yellow here is larger scalar field and kind of has a 1 over r fall off to infinity. Okay, so now what we want to do is we want to change the coupling constant, look at different mass ratio, and answer really two questions. The first one is, well, what do the merger dynamics look like? I mean, this is really what we need numerical relativity after all. So is there any novel gravitational wave signatures or maybe some important nonlinear effects that perturbative methods wouldn't capture? And then the second question we want to answer is how accurate are PN predictions for this theory. So remember I told you that the most stringent bounds on this theory so far are using PN theory for the in spiral on black hole neutron star events. And so it's very important to know how accurate those PN predictions are in the first place. And then more like, you know, long-term plan, if you're actually thinking of doing your template bank of like some modified theory of gravity, so come up with like loads of waveforms, the approach would be to combine PN theory for the in spiral, numerical relativity for the merger, and then perturbation theory for the ring down. And so one step towards this would be to actually use numerical relativity to kind of like see how accurate PN predictions are. Okay, so let's start with the numerical or the merger dynamics. So what you have here is you have the gravitational wave emission for a nickel mass binary at different couplings. So the dash dotted green line here is the movie I just showed you earlier. And so here you can see like, you know, the emission slightly before merger and then also including the ring down. And so the first thing to note here is that even though this is a nickel mass binary, and so the dipolar radiation is suppressed because the black holes have the same scalar charge, you still get some noticeable dephasing, which is also such that as you turn on the coupling, the black holes will in spiral faster, which is consistent with this additional energy loss through scalar radiation. Now, looking at the amplitude, you can see that there's very, like, it depends very weakly on the coupling. And this is very important because if you go to papers where they use this order perturbative, this order reduction scheme I told you about, you'll find that there, what they find is that the gravitational wave amplitude scales quadratically with the coupling, which is clearly not what we're finding here. So presumably the latter is really just because of those secular effect I was telling you about. And then looking at the ring down there, again, you can see the amplitude maybe depends very weakly on the coupling, but there's not much there. And then the other thing is that looking at the frequency and the decay rates on the quasi-normal modes, the effect of the modified gravity, well, they're actually quite small. And so we decided to not look at it, at least in a quantitative, not make any quantitative statement and leave this to a further study. Okay, and then you can do the same for the scalar waveform. So here what we did is we already scaled out the test field dependence. And so you can see that there is very little non-linear enhancement in the waveform. So the bottom line here is that the main effect from like modifying gravity really seems to be on the dephasing, so this like, you know, more rapid in spiral rather than on the amplitude. And this is not necessarily a bad thing because this is also what gravitational wave detectors are the most sensitive to. And so maybe to confirm this idea, here you can see the gravitational waveforms for the equal mass 3:2 and 2:1 mass ratio at different couplings aligned at earlier times. And so here you can really see this clear dephasing during the in spiral. So here the 0, 0 would correspond to GR. Similarly, you can also see this in the scalar waveforms. I guess those are less important because we can't actually detect them. So what we want to do now is we actually want to, you know, compare this dephasing we're seeing in our numerical simulations to PN theory and see whether they agree or not. And so this is what this plot is trying to show. So let me walk you through it. Each figure represents a different mass ratio. So let's maybe just focus on the left one, the equal mass ratio for now. The x-axis represents the coupling. So it's this like lambda of my theory over the smallest mass squared. And then on the y-axis, just focusing on the dots, each dot represents the difference between the orbital phase of the gravitational wave between GR and a non-GR waveforms at a particular coupling and at a particular frequency. And then the lines are basically whatever PN theory would predict at different like consecutive orders. So the leading, so for instance, for the equal mass ratio, because the dipolar radiation is suppressed, the minus one PN contribution is zero, but then you have the first contribution at zero PN, and then you can go and so forth all the way up to 2 PN, which is what PN can predict to at the moment. And so really the bottom line here, as you can see from like the discrepancy between the dots and the lines, is that clearly PN theory, at least in the very last few stages of the merger, is underestimating this dephasing. You might be thinking, well, why? Well, after doing a careful data error analysis, what we concluded was that the reason is just presumably because we're comparing the phase very late into the N-spiral, so already close to merger, where already in GR you would need more orders in the PN expansion to match the phase two numerical simulations. And so this brings me to the conclusion, and I don't want to just conclude here. I actually want to spend a bit more time about things I've been thinking about in terms of future direction. So the only conclusion I'll give you is that we finally have the numerical tools to answer questions such as what does the gravitational wave signal look like in a modified theory of gravity? And so I think that's actually quite exciting because it took a very long time to get here. But there's still a lot to do. Such as, for instance, solving the initial data problem in those theories, and also kind of like determine the domain of existence where those theories are actually well posed, and so can give predictions that can then be compared with gravitational wave observations. Right now, we're having a hard time going through merger for higher couplings and unequal mass ratios. So presumably, this is just because of the formation of elliptic regions as you get closer to merger. In which case a higher resolution, maybe a different gauge or a more complicated excision surface would help. So those are all kind of like technical issues, but which I think are very important to like kind of solve moving forward. In terms of physics, though, there's a lot of very interesting things we can look at. The first one would be to, so right now what we did is we compared our waveforms to PN theory. But another thing which I think would be very interesting is to compare our waveforms to those other approximate methods I told you about earlier, such as the order reduction approach and the fixing the equations, because then this would allow us to like kind of like estimate the errors which are introduced by those methods, which are presumably not as numerically challenging. An obvious next step would also to actually study the detectability of the ES modifications on our gravitational waveforms and actually like, you know, look at degeneracies with GR and see whether we can detect any modifications of general relativity. And related to that, another thing one could think of doing would be to use our waveforms to come up with more meaningful theognostic tests and make sure we're testing things from first principles. Then one thing you could do is that, so here we looked at quasi-circular binary black hole mergers, but you could expand the parameter space. And one thing I have in mind is, for instance, include spin. And the reason I want to include spin is because we know that this could actually lead to some new novel gravitational signatures, such as in like spin-induced spontaneous calorization. Related to that, and this is important to emphasize, the numerical tools we used here can be applied to any Hondensky theory as long as it's in the weakly coupled regime. So this means that we can not only look at different Gauss-Bonnet couplings, some of which might lead to spontaneous scalarization, but we could also look at theories like K-essence or Gauss condensation, which could account for the late time acceleration of the universe. So this is a very powerful tool we have here. And then last but not least, one thing I'm particularly excited about would be to actually study neutron star binaries in those theories. And the reason is that if we could actually, you know, find some kind of like effect from this modified gravity on not only the gravitational wave signal, but also the electromagnetic signal, this means that this would actually allow us to test gravity in a regime that ground-based detectors are less sensitive to. And that's it for me. I guess you guys have a lot of questions for those not in the field.
So go back to the fact that you were comparing the PN stuff data. So I'm not sure that I'm getting it right. So if I consider an AMD system with a very large mass ratio or small, then the PN would be okay, right? Because you are at the very beginning of your x-axis, right? Because one of the black holes is always very mass supermassive, and then the parameter which is because inversely proportional with N, right? So for super massive black hole, you have very low state of charge.
Yes, but so that's a really good question. So what happens is that the amount of scalar radiation that your system is going to emit is proportional to the difference between the scalar charges. And so in the Emery case, you have a supermassive black hole, so the scalar charge is effectively zero. But then you have this point particle, which is a lot smaller, and so the difference in scalar charge is huge. And because it's an Emery and it's going to go through a lot of, like, you know, orbits, and LISA is going to see a lot of those, the accumulated dephasing is going to be huge. And there's one paper that came out literally last week about, like, how we could, like, constrain those theories, but with a massive scalar using Emery's and LISA.
Yes, yes. I'm aware of the secondary one. What I'm asking is that the PN, because what they do is that mostly the gravitational wave from the Emery's, and most accurate one are these kind of driven things that is based on the energy loss.
Right.
So if I want to add the scalar flux to the scalar energy loss to my flux, it would be the post-Newtonian would be enough, right?
Yeah, it'll be more accurate the further apart your binaries are. Like when the velocity.
Maybe for the M, because they're not going to conclude. They're not considering the very, very late close to mergers thing.
Right. Yeah, when they're far enough, like presumably here, so like I said, we're looking already quite far into this spiral, but if you were to like have super long numerical waveform and so the, like, you know, they would be extremely widely separated, PN theory would be accurate, I think, the deface.
Thank you. I still have one more question. Anyone? No one else? So for such a Emery systems, no matter how large is your coupling constant is, they consider the system like in such a way that it is a minimal coupling. Is it because one of the black holes is super massive and the other one is small, so that one is in the background, so the metric wouldn't couple that?
Are you sure that's not just the scalar tensor theory? Is it the same theory?
I'm not sure.
I mean, like, I don't think you can. I mean, this is like, I mean, like, I when remember the action
to your main equation in the beginning.
I think you can't really. I mean,
so over there. I mean, so if my background metric, there's almost no scalar field on the main black hole, right? Relative to the smaller one.
Well, if you do like perturbation theory.
Yeah. What else you can do?
Well, then the zero order, you'll just have GR.
Yes.
And then because of the form we picked for the coupling, so what you'll have is so this is G, and can you read this?
Yeah.
So this is the equation of motion for the scalar field up to a factor of two or whatever. So you can see here that the space-time curvature is always going to source a scalar field. So that's what I was saying about the black holes having scalar charge. And so what you have is, you have at zero of order, you just have GR. And then you can use this solution to source your scalar field at first order. And then at second order, you use your first order scalar field to then find the corrections in the metric. So maybe that's what you're thinking about. But then that's the thing I told you about, that it has like kind of like, like it's fine to like the first, we compare the first order scalar field solutions to our solutions, and they agree very well, which is kind of what this plot was trying to show here. But you can see there's very little nonlinear effect. Like if I divide by the amplitude of my lambda, then they basically match, which is what, you know, doing this, like solving at first order would give you. But then if you actually solve for the metric, that's where you get those like problems. So maybe that's why you're saying, like, you know, minimally coupled, like, yeah, they kind of decouple.
Thank you.
So you're saying basically the PN are inaccurate, and then
those results to the actions and symptoms made. Right.
Right. Well, if anything, they're conservative because we're finding the dephasing to be actually larger than what they predicted, right? And so their constraints, I guess we could be placing better constraints on our view.
And then kind of a related question. So you were saying that the next right binary could be left on the 3D series, but then with gradation wave with very close compact binaries, you can render, or is it similar?
So I think the best way to constrain those theories with ground-based detectors is with black hole neutron stars, because neutron stars don't have a scalar charge in this theory, and black holes do. So the difference in scalar charge is the larger in those systems. Now, the question of whether you can constrain the theory better with black hole neutron stars versus EMRIs, I don't know. I mean, I guess the thing is with LISA, you're going to see so many orbits before. Even just stellar mass binaries, the constraints you would be able to place on the theory would be much better than we can do now with LIGO events.
Right. In an extra binary, you have a black hole and then some other compact object. And I guess the advantage there is you see it for a way longer. You can see it for as long as you can observe, but in LIGO, you see it for a second or less.
Oh, you're talking about the other constraints I was talking about. Those constraints are weaker. Yeah, I'm not too sure actually. I don't know.
You should have better on the orbital mechanics, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's what people used to do. Kent Yagi did a lot on that. He was the one that did this. But I'm actually not too sure why constraints are weak. Maybe it's just because the mass of the H3 binaries are larger, so the scalar charge is smaller around the black holes. What's the, in terms of solar masses, what's kind of mass?
Yeah, it's over 10.
But that's not that large, right? No. Yeah, I actually don't know.
Can I quickly ask a silly question?
Yeah.
What would you differentiate
between some ultralight scalar particle and scalar degrees of freedom? When you say ultralight, you just mean outer scalar field, which is minimally coupled to?
Like a lesser field, new particles.
Oh, well, black holes wouldn't have a scalar charge in those theories. So, for instance, neutron stars don't have a scalar charge in those theories. You wouldn't see that effect. No. Right?
It depends.
Oh, it depends. Or maybe you can give an answer. Yeah, but the effect would be different, right?
Yeah, the charge would be there, but you still have other effects.
Sorry, what's the difference between cumulative and density of scalar field around your black hole and the black hole having the scalar charge?
But you wouldn't have an additional loss of dipolar radiation.
It doesn't need to shine, it can just lose the membrane force.
I think the signature you would be getting here is really an accumulation, because you have this constant additional energy loss of scalar radiation. I think you wouldn't have that in this.
All right, thanks. Let's talk again.